This is the State of Things from the American Tobacco Historic District. I'm Frank Stachow. Conservationists and the Pentagon have been working together for years to protect hundreds of threatened endangered species on American military bases. The partnership started in the early 1990s at Fort Bragg. The base is one of many that's become a biological time capsule for wildlife. Joining me now is Jay Price. He is WUNC's military reporter, and he's been following this story as part of WUNC's American Homefront project. Welcome back, Jay.
Thanks for having me, Frank.
Fascinating collaboration, and it dates back to the 90s. Tell us how this got started. How did conservationists and the Pentagon get together to preserve wildlife on military bases?
One animal, one very, very oddly social creature, the red-cockaded woodpecker. And, if anybody is out there who's been around the state for a while, they've heard that, sometimes with an expletive attached to it back in the day. The woodpecker is federally listed as endangered. And in 1990, the U.S. Fish and Wildlife Service issued an order that the base had to protect it. Training stopped on several parts of the base, and soldiers had to be bussed out of state to Virginia and Georgia for a while for some training. And it was a big national issue. Jesse Helms tried to get this blocked, get the endangered thing not to be something they could use on bases. But the Army decided that instead of fighting the woodpecker, fighting the designation, they were going to reach out to outside groups like the Nature Conservancy for help in building that population of woodpeckers up on and off the base. Once they got the population high enough, they could go back to training. And they did exactly that. It was really successful, and training got back to normal. And this partnership became a big national model.
Great, and a creative solution to what could be a simple political kind of black and white issue. Are they crazy? They're going to stop training because of a woodpecker. And the Army says, well, I think there's another way around this. Very clever, very creative. And but the other part of this, though, is that it's not just about protecting endangered species. I use the term biological time capsule. Tell us about the ecology of these bases and why the military itself thinks it's important to preserve it.
Well, a couple of key things to understand about all this is that many U.S. bases predate World War II, and some of the largest are a century old. Fort Bragg, Lewis McChord out in Washington. The U.S. population was a third of its current size when those bases were created, and it hadn't gobbled up so much land for farms and houses. And so these bases are really large, a lot larger than cities in some cases. So they're these kind of giant swaths of pre-war terrain, not completely unspoiled, but in many ways protected. And they have the highest density per acre of threatened and endangered species of any federal lands. I mean, think about that. More than national parks, more than Yellowstone, whatever. And the military's taken really aggressive steps in recent years to look out for them, partnering up with these groups and others. And the reason is training. I mean, they need to protect the training. It's all about that. It's not about some bleeding heart thing on the military side for wanting. They need realistic landscapes. If they're going to be fighting in the desert, they need a realistic desert. They need Fort Irwin in California. If they're going to be fighting in forests, they need realistic forests. They need healthy, realistic terrain, good beaches. And so it's all about kind of protecting the training, which means protecting the environment.
What about the incentive for bases to work with conservation groups? That's an interesting collaboration. How did that collaboration come together? And was it kind of an easy fit, or did it take a while to get the two cultures to mesh?
I think it was easier than people would guess. Military folks spend a lot of time outdoors. They're outdoor people in many ways. They live and work outdoors to a great degree. And a lot of them are conservationists. A lot of them are hunters, fishermen. They like the outdoors in many cases. And this wasn't as unnatural a fit as it might sound like in some ways. But also, they, from the very beginning, weren't cynical about this. They were all looking, the Nature Conservancy, whoever, the Army, the Navy, the Marines, they were all looking for overlapping interests, places where they could have win-wins. And there were plenty to be had here.
It's interesting when you talk about the preserving the bases and the various ecosystems for training purposes, places we might find ourselves in battle. That all makes sense. It does sound like a difficult chore for the military to protect an endangered species. Was that a kind of a hard fit for them? In other words, the idea, this does seem a little bit more off mission. How did that play with the brass in the military?
Well, there's kind of two ways to think about it. There's the on-base stuff and the off-base stuff. On bases, they had had kind of a mission for a while because of the Sykes Act from the early 60s to kind of look out for the ecology of the bases. And, you know, they've got biologists. Fort Bragg has biologists. A lot of bases have teams of biologists that kind of look out for the on-base ecosystems. So they were tuned up on it, but also they needed help. If they were going to go the full distance on protecting entire ecosystems and literally hundreds of threatened and endangered species, they were going to need to partner up with people who had expertise and, frankly, who had money. I mean, you think of the Pentagon's having unlimited budgets, but not for everything. They do have budgets. And so they were able to attract kind of matching funds through these partnerships. They spent $1.5 billion so far in the last few years on land and conservation rights for property off base. And they've attracted another $500 million from these outside partners.
We talked about the pileated woodpecker at the beginning of the program, but a butterfly plays an important part of this when it comes to the story of Fort Bragg. Tell us about that.
So this butterfly, I mean, I'm laughing. I mean, you think, but it's a really interesting story. The St. Francis Satyr is one of the rarest butterflies in the world, maybe the rarest, but there's no way to know that because it lives on the artillery practice range. There's only a few city blocks where it has habitat in the entire world, and it's all on Fort Bragg. And this was its last refuge. And this may be hard to believe. Because it needs fire, the explosions from the shells landing all around it, development off base and modern controls on wildfires really destroyed its habitat off of base. So this was the last place it would stay alive where explosives were raining down. So it needs to be essentially killed to be protected.
Well, it's interesting. I think we should study it to see how any animal survives on an artillery training base. We need to learn from this butterfly how you actually make that your habitat. But actually, you talked to an expert at NC State about this. Tell us about him and what he has to say.
Nick Haddad, he's one of those rock star professors you always hope that you get when you go to college. And he's been studying the butterfly for years and years and years and helping restore it.
The artillery sets fires annually or almost annually, and those fires burn across the forest, keeping it open, but they also burn across the wetlands, keeping the wetlands open. These butterflies need disturbance for their populations to survive. An interesting feature of the artillery ranges is that as you move towards the center of the range, you get more and more open wetlands. They're all very well interconnected, and so the butterfly's population can be healthy and can thrive.
That's NC State biologist Nick Haddad at Fort Bragg, who talked with my guest today, WUNC military reporter Jay Price. An interesting story about him and sort of how he does his research, again, on an artillery practice field.
Yeah, it's kind of crazy. When he was talking there, I was taping him right on the edge of the field, and there were practice grenades laying all around. The butterfly, its main habitat is where those artillery shells land, and there are a lot of them that don't explode, and they can still explode. So he only is allowed on, and he's happy to have any time on the range. It's very valuable to get on the range. The Army works very hard to keep people off of it for obvious reasons, but they only let him on typically about 2 days a year, and he's got to hope the weather's good because he's looking for butterflies. He's also hoping that the hatching season is timed just right for it, and they only let him on while he's accompanied with an explosives expert. And they find shells. I've got tape of him, they're spotting shells as they go along and grenades. And it's pretty dangerous stuff. There's snakes. But he just loves it in there. He just describes it as this wonderful kind of Eden, this paradise of plants and animals that don't really survive anywhere else. These rare orchids, rare pitcher plants. He loves it.
It just occurred to me another unintended consequence of this. Not only could we study the butterfly to see how to survive an artillery barrage, but the other side of this is, would the military make it its mission to go go out across the world and create habitat for butterflies using military? I doubt it.
You laugh. And it sounds like a crazy story, yeah. Right? Butterflies, the Army helping, the conservation groups, you know, professors on the, you know, going through these impact zones with all these dangerous shells. This is really rare butterfly. There's another one in Pennsylvania on an artillery range. There's another one in Washington State on an artillery range, and the Army's helping in both cases. Those things sound rare. Really, they're now becoming kind of typical.
Yeah, and it's also interesting to think about. I mean, it's one thing to train on a particular terrain and learn how to get over it and not have it overwhelm you. But I would think a more detailed understanding about the ecology can't hurt military planning either. And so working with these conservationists and biologists may have had the consequence of helping for planning as well.
Yeah, and that's what they do. They do a lot of planning. It's just this is just the tip of the iceberg. If you think about kind of the green side of the military, they're very practical about the effects of global warming. They can't be deniers. They have to be practical about planning ahead for things, and they're not going to ignore things they know are true. So they're planning for what rise in water level they're going to see on beaches where they train, in harbors where they have their ships docked. How climate change patterns are going to affect conflict, where conflicts might spring up due to climate change effects.
I have just about 30 seconds left, but any plan to expand this program?
Yeah, there's a fairly new program. Last 3 years, it's just sprung out of this that has really taken a target. They're going after protection of farms and working forests, what's so-called working lands. In eastern North Carolina, 33 counties there were just designated one of the first of these areas where they'll be helping with federal money protect some of the farms and timber forests around the bases.
Fascinating stuff. Jay, as always, thank you so much.
Glad to be here. Thanks
Jay
for having
Price, me. WUNC military reporter, part of the American Homefront Project. More details at our website, stateofthings.org. Just had preview a new theater production that takes us inside the minds of some of the most well-known princesses. You'll hear about it on the State of Things from North Carolina Public Radio, a broadcast service of the University of North Carolina at Chapel Hill. Please stay with us.